Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Yesterday, Bloomberg Businessweek released its cover story in bold letters. It's global warming stupid. Yesterday morning, editor Josh Triangle tweeted, "Our cover story this week may generate controversy, but only among the stupid." The media have been widely criticized this week for failing to make the connections between Hurricane Sandy and climate change, or to at least have an in-depth conversation about climate change. BuzzFeed notes that NBC's Chuck Todd was one of the only national reporters who's made the connection. He said, quote, "Let's not bury our heads in the sand. Something has changed in the Atlantic. The climate has changed. It's called climate change, folks." And then we got the Bloomberg Businessweek story, which is getting widespread attention. And New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, a Republican turned independent, endorsed Barack Obama for president. When Stevenson, a former editor for the Boston Globe and the Atlantic, wrote a damning letter to his former colleagues for failing to take climate change seriously, he wrote, quote, "I think we agree a journalist's ultimate responsibility is to the public, and yet, by that measure, you are failing." Well, joining us to talk about media coverage of Hurricane Sandy and climate change, there are so many other angles to this. We're talking about the poor, the homeless, how Hurricane Sandy has affected Cuba and Haiti. We are joined by Mark Hertzgard. He's fellow of the New America Foundation. He's the nation's environmental correspondent. He has covered climate change for 20 years and is the author of 6 books, including most recently Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. And Mark is one of the few journalists to point out in his latest piece, Hurricane Sandy as a Greek Tragedy, that President Obama was finally questioned about the emission of climate change last week in an interview with MTV. And the president said he was, quote, surprised that climate change had not come up in the debates. Mark writes, as if he himself had nothing to do with the result. After all, he's only the president of the United States. Yet somehow, Obama found plenty of time in the debates to brag about the record amount of oil drilling and pipeline laying his administration has presided over. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rose.
I'm so glad you pointed out that MTV question because I had not heard about that, so I can't wait to talk about that.
Okay.
And we are also joined by David Roberts, staff writer for Grist, an environmental news and commentary website. And David has been covering this for his blog and pointing out that climate change was brought up during the vice presidential debate back in 1988. And there was major agreement that climate change was actually happening back then. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So as we always do on Friday, we'd like to start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, David, why don't we start off with you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Sure. Actually, despite the sort of grim tone with which you introduced this stuff, I actually think there has been quite a bit of good journalism making the Sandy climate change connection. Maybe I just have a sort of a low baseline, a low bar that I'm trying to clear, but I actually had an embarrassment of riches this week. One thing I wanted to call attention to is a segment on NBC News with Brian Williams, which the title was, extreme weather is the new normal. Not that the segment was, it's just a short news segment. It's not all that particularly brilliant, but it was straightforward, and it didn't do any he said, she said kind of false balance. And it just said, this is what we can expect now. And it's not so much that it was a brilliant segment as it's on network news. And network news, for better or worse, still reaches far, far more people than any cable news or any print publication. This is Middle America being reached here. And I think it's a credit to NBC that they did it without hedging.
And in fact, BuzzFeed noted that NBC is one of the only networks that has been covering this in those terms. I mean, with Chuck Todd basically saying it's called climate change, folks. Let's just deal with it.
Yes, and MSNBC as well. Their hosts are great on this. Chris Hayes, in particular, who hosts MSNBC's shows on Saturday and Sunday, has been absolutely spectacular in his monologues and bringing on guests to discuss this in more depth. So there are some heroes out there.
All right, so kudos to NBC and Brian Williams from David Roberts. And Mark, what about you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I would cite, I agree with much of what David just said, but I would also repeat what you said at the top of the show here. I thought that the that cover of Business Week is, I think, will go down as a landmark moment in the American media coverage of climate change. This is a big deal because it's going to be seen by the rest of the media. You know, Bloomberg is Bloomberg Business Week is obviously a business-oriented publication. They're not a bunch of left-wing nutcases over there, and for them to be that outspoken is really important. In a similar way, you mentioned Chuck Todd at NBC. I think there'll also be sort of ripple effects from what he says, because Todd is the definition of the inside the Beltway mentality, incremental centrist. In some ways, so much of what's wrong with the mainstream media is epitomized by Chuck Todd. But when Chuck Todd, even Chuck Todd, starts saying that, hey, this is climate change, that's significant. And I think it gets to something that's broader here in the question of the media, that with Hurricane Sandy, climate change became personal to the media. This hurricane went right through the headquarters of the American news media in New York City. And so no longer was it poor and dark-skinned and faraway people who are suffering from these disasters. We've had a lot of these climate disasters in recent years that never got this kind of attention. It's getting this attention now precisely because it happened to them. Mm. And, you know, my editor, for example, at the Daily Beast Newsweek, he had to leave Lower Manhattan and move uptown because there's no power and no water down there. So I think this is a really significant moment. And while I agree with David that there's been, you know, a refreshing amount of coverage now, it is a shame and still a disgrace for the media that it took so long for them to get this. It's not like the rest of the world hasn't been, and the rest of the world's media haven't been on this page for a long time. And that's why finally I think, and I know we'll talk more about this, but the real piece that I think is great this week is Wen Stevenson's piece that basically calls out his colleagues in the mainstream media for failing us in their coverage of climate change over the years.
Yes, and thank you, Mark, for emailing that to us yesterday, because that is a very eye-opening piece. So there's so many angles to talk about here. Let's first dive in and talk about, you know, what is the big picture here? Mark, do you think it would specifically focus on the science behind climate change and the fact that so little has been done about this politically? I mean, how, as an editor, how do you go about covering this huge story?
I think Wen Stevenson has a very good suggestion in his piece, which I really commend to everyone to read in the Boston Phoenix. And it's flying around the internet.
And so let's listeners know about this. So Wen Steven is a former editor at The Atlantic and the Boston Globe. He was a senior producer of NPR's On Point. And he had a meeting inside the offices of the Boston Globe with the editorial page editor Peter Canellos and members of the staff to basically protest their lack of coverage. Wen got so frustrated with the lack of coverage that he sort of jumped ship and became a climate activist, because he said this is all about...
Hi, you've reached the Roberts. Please leave us a...
He said it's all about the next generations. So just to give a little bit of background about who Wen Stevenson is.
Yeah, and Wen had that meeting on October 2nd, and he describes in the piece that he really didn't get very far convincing his former colleagues, with whom he's friends, because they continued to sort of take very sort of narrow and short-term perspectives on this, like, well, what is this going to mean for natural gas prices in Massachusetts, and how will it affect the election? And when Stevenson was trying to say, no, you're not getting it here. I'm not here for those reasons. I'm here because I have two children, and I am scared to death for their future, and you and the media are failing. And specifically what Wen suggested in terms of getting back to your earlier question, Rose, about what should editors be doing, Wen said, you know, cover it like the crisis that it is. And guys and gals in the media, you know how to do that. You know how to do crisis coverage. Flood the zone, to borrow a football analogy. You throw a lot of resources at the story. You put it on the front page day after day after day, and specifically he said, look at what the media did after the 9/11 terrorist attacks. you saw all kinds of stories about all aspects of that crisis, an admitted crisis, and you saw stories on the front page that would have never been on the front page in the absence of that kind of crisis. Well, that's what the media needs to be doing now, is to be treating climate change as the crisis that it is, and looking at it the way, and again, you know, this is, I'm talking here about the U.S. media, because the overseas media gets this. You look at this one quote from The Economist recently. Last year, The Economist, the British business magazine, wrote that 100 years from now, if and when there's people looking back at this moment, no issue will matter more than did we do something about climate change. And yet, if you look at the American media coverage, especially of this campaign year, you know, there's been climate silence. And as Wen Stevenson said in his piece, climate silence is death.
And David, what are your thoughts about this? Because Wen also says, when I became a journalist, I did not check my conscience, my citizenship, or my humanity at the door. Nor when I became an advocate and activist, did I sacrifice my intellectual honesty. If anything, I salvaged it. It's time to end the self-censorship and get over the idea that journalists are somehow above the fray. You are not above the fray. What it all comes down to is which side are you on? What are your thoughts about that, David?
Yeah, I think it's very interesting the way this issue, the way climate change, just by its nature, challenges a lot of the conventions that have grown up around traditional journalism in the U.S. It's very, journalists pride themselves these days on, you know, reporting just the facts and not throwing their own interpretations in and not editorializing or anything like that. But it's very difficult to cover climate change properly if you're just listing facts, because what's significant about climate change is its meaning, is the long-term narrative, is the larger narrative about it, what it means for our culture, what it means for our energy system. So it's very hard to cover this issue meaningfully without shading over into interpretation and without shading over into narrative building. And that kind of thing, I think, makes conventional journalists a little bit nervous. They feel like they're out on a limb when they do that kind of thing. But I think Wynn's challenge is exactly right. If you want to cover this honestly, if you want to serve the public, what the public needs is not, you know, a list of scientific statistics. What the public needs on this issue is meaning. They want to know what it means for them. And that kind of thing is a new kind of challenge for journalism, at least as it's defined itself.
And what's also interesting about this is there are so many more environmental journalists today compared to, say, the early 90s, so much more research being done. We had Mother Jones' Kate Shepherd on recently, and she was joining us from the Society of Environmental Journalists Conference in Lubbock, Texas. So, Mark, can you talk about that, just the fact that there are so many more environmental journalists today?
Sure, that's very true, but those environmental journalists operate within the larger framework and the larger structures and, above all, the larger ideology of the mainstream media. And so it's their editors and producers and the management above them that still shape the general direction. It's at that level, the senior management and editorial level, that they make the kind of decisions that Wen Stevenson is talking about when saying, apply crisis coverage to this, put it on the front page, or in the case of Business Week this week, put it on the cover and be outspoken. That's not what the environmental, that's above the pay grade and the decision-making power of your average environment beat reporter. And so that's really, I think, where a lot of our focus has to be. And you can see this if you look back at, one of the real low moments of media coverage of climate change in the United States, and that's saying a lot, but at the so-called ClimateGate scandal that erupted over the stolen emails out of East Anglia University in Britain right before the Copenhagen Climate Summit in 2009. Now, virtually every environmental beat reporter that I know in the United States knew perfectly well that that was a BS story, that not only was it sort of cherry-picking data and so forth, but that the fundamental science behind climate change was not at all shaken by that false scandal. But nevertheless, you saw story after story after story being done at that time by the media, and that was coming, I'm convinced, mainly from their superiors, saying, hey, you know, we need to be fair to both sides on this. You need to look at the alternative. We can't be covering up and so forth. And that's coming from their editors and their producers. It's not coming from the beat reporters.
That is Mark Hertzgaard, the nation's environmental correspondent, author of Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. We're also joined by David Roberts, staff writer for Grist, an environmental news and commentary website. And we are talking about media coverage of Superstorm Sandy. What really struck you and what changes have you seen over the past week? I also wanted to mention that the death toll of Sandy along the eastern seaboard has jumped to 98. More bodies are being found every day. And I also wanted to give kudos to ABC, who had a piece called We Need Food, We Need Clothing. Staten Island residents plead for help 3 days after Sandy. And we will be talking also just about how the media are covering the poor and the homeless, and then people with disabilities who live in high rises who cannot get down because the elevators are not working. So what really strikes you? If you saw a piece that you thought was done well or gave you some insight, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment on our website. How do you think the media should be covering something like this Superstorm Sandy? And then if there was a story you saw somewhere else that didn't have anything to do with the superstorm, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. So what about that aspect of it, Mark? I mean, there are so many other angles. I was just searching poverty and Sandy on Twitter. Found a little bit, but not too much. A lot of independent journalists went out on the streets of New York and talked to a number of homeless people who said, you know, there's just no room in the shelters because they're helping so many families. So what about those angles?
Yeah, I think you're beginning to see those angles. And, you know, the BBC is covering that already. I've seen even a little bit in the Times, but they're not making that connection yet to climate change. And let's parallel this to Hurricane Katrina, for example. In the days after Hurricane Katrina, there was a lot of focus on poverty and suffering and so forth, very little on climate change. But that's where I think examples like the Brian Williams piece that David mentioned, and the Business Week cover, and Chuck Todd and so forth, and let's not forget Mayor Bloomberg's endorsement of President Obama yesterday, specifically on the grounds of climate change, that all of those, that is what begins to change the mentality of those senior decision makers in the media, the producers and the editors, as well as reporters, but especially the bosses, and get them to begin to say, okay, we've got to tie climate change into all this. So I, you know, as someone who's very often very critical of my media colleagues, I want to give them the benefit of the doubt on this, and to think that in the hours and days to come that they will begin to make those connections more. But I'd be interested to hear what David thinks about that.
What are your thoughts, David?
Well, I think it's generally true that U.S. media overlooks issues of poverty and income inequality and the sort of differential impact of these things on the different classes. But what I'd really like to see, as long as the media's, you know, got its getting ambitious, is something connecting these issues, so connecting climate change and poverty. Because, you know, we think of climate change as a scientific issue, but the fact is all of its impacts are going to hit the poor and vulnerable the hardest. And that you're seeing that in a very clear way in New York right now.
Right.
But it's going to be even more clear in coming years globally. I mean, think about it. This storm hit one of the richest, you know, the richest city and the richest country in the world. And so if you have this sort of suffering in the wake of Sandy and this sort of inequality of response, in response to Sandy in this city, imagine, you know, the next storm that hits Bangladesh or some poor area of the world. You're going to see, you know, 10 times the suffering. So climate change is not unconnected to these class issues, and I would like to see the media pull that connection out a little bit.
Well, and in response, New York City added 5 shelters, and in August, before this even happened, the New York Times had a piece called New York City Homeless Shelters in Record Demand, and then the latest numbers in terms of children, New York homeless children in New York City shelters rises to 19,000, a record. So clearly there are major, major issues here. Mark, what do you think, how should the media cover this angle?
It's entirely right that it's always the poor that get hit the hardest. you know, they should. It's not rocket science to cover this stuff. You send reporters out, you talk to the people affected, and you write it. You know, there's people all over New York City, and I would specifically, I'd be going into Brooklyn and Queens, especially the western edge of Brooklyn is very, very low-lying, and parts of Queens, too, are low-lying, and I imagine there's been terrible damage there. We've seen quite a bit of coverage of the fire in Queens that destroyed, at last count, 111 homes. So I would be going into those places and talking to the people, and then also talking to the folks at the Red Cross and a number of the other groups that are working on this. The Red Cross, by the way, is an unsung hero on this whole question of climate change and poverty, internationally in particular. They were the first organization, back 10 years ago now, to say that climate change is an issue for disaster preparedness and for poverty around the world, and that we as an organization, and therefore governments and other international institutions like the UN, have got to be paying much more attention to this. And so I would be looking to people like that as my sort of scientific sources on this, and just write it and write it and write it until you embarrass the government officials into doing something. And let's not forget also, I'd be going to the Romney campaign, as to their credit reporters have done, and forcing Governor Romney to explain his comments earlier this campaign year that he wanted to do away with FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Administration, which is responsible, of course, for responding to these events. And Governor Romney, while trying to sway the Republican base during the primary, said that, yes, he wanted to absolutely get rid of FEMA and put all that stuff back to the states, or even better yet, to the private sector. Well, the other day, I think yesterday or the day before, when Romney was trying to basically look like he cares about this, he was working not a shelter, but a place that was sort of pulling together supplies and so forth for the hurricane victims. Reporters got close to him and started shouting, "Governor, do you still want to shut down FEMA? Governor, do you still believe in shutting down FEMA? Governor, why won't you answer the question? Governor, we've asked you the question 14 times now." And he just kept that same awkward grin that he had on his face when a protester interrupted his speech the other day and asked about climate. So, you know, if this is something that I think needs to be pursued with Romney. And that's easier for the press to do. They know how to do that. That's kind of typical campaign coverage. But what would be nice is to see the kind of enterprise reporting going into those places and let the people who are hit by this give them voice.
And maybe meld the two. And I'm so glad you brought this up, because the New York Times had an editorial on October 29th called "A Big Storm Requires Big Government." And the lead says, "Most Americans have never heard of the National Response Coordination Center, but they're lucky it exists on days of lethal winds and flood tides. The center is the war room of FEMA." And then they pointed out that Mitt Romney wants to eliminate it. They also pointed out that over the last 2 years, congressional Republicans have forced a 43% reduction in the primary FEMA grants that pay for disaster preparedness. Did you see that op-ed, Mark?
You know, that's all correct and to the good.
We're speaking with Mark Hertzgard with The Nation magazine, author of Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. David Roberts is a staff writer for Grist, an environmental news and commentary website. And we are talking about media coverage of Superstorm Sandy and how things have changed over this past week. It's been fascinating to watch. Mayor Bloomberg, former Republican turned independent, has just endorsed President Obama. And then Bloomberg Businessweek story says boldly, "It's global warming stupid." And we'll talk about that later. It does actually call for fracking, which isn't getting much attention. So what are your thoughts on media coverage of Hurricane Sandy? What stories have you seen that have given you some insight that you might not have seen in other places? It's your call, and we'll be back after this. There's a lot at stake in the 2012 election, and as it comes to a close, stay tuned to KALW for comprehensive and interactive coverage. I'm Rose Aguilar, and Tuesday at 5 p.m., I'll be kicking off our live election night broadcast from the Freight and Salvage in Berkeley. I'll be joined by longtime political analyst Larry Bensky, and I hope you'll be part of our conversation. It all starts at 5 p.m., Election Night Live, here on KALW.
All the stories you hear recommended on the Friday Weekly Media Roundtable are posted at yourcallradio.org. They're also included in Your Call's weekly email newsletter. It's easy to sign up for and free. Just go to yourcallradio.org and click the email newsletter link.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. And coming up on Monday, if you've got any last-minute questions about the ballot propositions, we've got 11 in California. And if you have any questions about voting, where you're supposed to vote, if you just any concerns or questions, we will pose them on Monday to members of the California Voter Foundation and the League of Women Voters. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us today for our weekly media roundtable, we're talking about coverage of Superstorm Sandy. And if there was another story that you saw this week, we would love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. We actually have full lines, so we'll have one open in just a couple minutes. You can also post a comment on our website or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We're joined today by David Roberts, staff writer for Grist, and Mark Hertzgard. He is the nation's environmental correspondent and author of Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. And let's hear from Kevin in Felton. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've been watching this issue closely, reading the science for over 20 years, and in my view, solving or dealing effectively with climate change is up against two really fundamental problems, the first of which is the human race's capacity for self-delusion. It's always inconvenient, as Al Gore pointed out years ago, to change the way you live, and so reducing our use of fossil fuels dramatically would change the way we live. And so it's very easy to convince people that it's nonsense because they don't want to have to do that. In other words, they don't want to have to imagine that we would have a high-speed rail system they could use to not sit in traffic that they seem to enjoy so much. And then the other point, apart from the issue of people's ability to delude themselves, is that politics is driven by, in almost all cases, it's driven by financial self-interest. And our country is, in my opinion, never been more under the sway of financial self-interest since the Second World War, the end of the war. It's been this building tsunami of corporate and private ownership of the political class. And so I'd like to hear your guests address these predicaments, which I think are yet to, despite how encouraging it was to see the Bloomberg article and hear the mayor of New York speak on this, I still think these two giant problems still exist, obviously. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Kevin. David, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's true that climate change poses some very, very deep problems for U.S. culture right now. I wanted to return briefly to the problems it poses to Mitt Romney, because I think this is actually an underexplored aspect of the of what's happening, is that this is a really, really terrible this is a terrible thing to happen right now for Mitt Romney, because, you know, all during the race, Mitt Romney has been trapped between his base in the Republican Party and the center, which he needs to appeal to win a presidential election. And that awkward grin that he's perfected, I think, is a result of so often being trapped between those two poles. And now his base wants him to ignore climate change, and climate change is in the news. His base wants him to slash social spending, and now the need for FEMA and disaster response and storm monitoring is very much in the news. His base wants him to devolve disaster relief to the states when the need for a federal response is in the news. So this is incredibly awkward right now, and I think it's an opportunity for political reporters to heighten some of these contradictions that Romney has been able to avoid for most of the race. But the caller is absolutely right that the larger problems face both parties. There are some very deeply entrenched financial interests that are threatened by solutions to this problem. And it gets back to that income inequality thing we were talking about earlier. The poor are going to be hurt hard at worst and first. But the ones who benefit most from the status quo are the wealthy. And the wealthy, I think we can all agree, have much more influence over the U.S. political system, both parties, than the poor at this point.
Well, and Mark, that's the question you raise in your piece. How long will big oil be allowed to hold the government hostage? How long will ExxonMobil's business plans take precedence over the well-being and indeed survival of our children?
Well, that's a question that we as citizens can help decide the answer to. I think that, you know, if there is a silver lining to this terrible disaster that struck New York City, and also let's remember New Jersey has really been hammered, and much of the other states along the East Coast, if there is a silver lining to this, it is that this gives us a strong invitation to really wake up and go beyond what we've done in the past and speak out and say, no, you know, we're not going to put up with this anymore. And we've got to take our government back from big oil. And while the caller is correct that money obviously plays a role in politics, it doesn't always win. And I get a little frustrated at times with the sentiment that says, oh, well, you know, big money is so powerful and controlling and so forth, because it very easily bleeds into passivity and cynicism. And frankly, as the father of a seven-year-old daughter who is going to be growing up in this world, no matter what, whether we deal with this or not, I get really impatient with that attitude. You know, it's not beyond our power to change this. And now is a perfect time to really get started. And for people who are interested, if there are other parents out there listening, I invite you to our website at climateparents.org. We are trying to finally give voice to parents and to organize parents around the climate issue, because they're the most underorganized constituency so far. And it's very interesting that yesterday when Mayor Bloomberg endorsed Obama, that he basically not explicitly, but essentially announced himself as a climate parent, because he said that when he goes into the voting booth, what he thinks about is the kind of world that he will leave behind for his two daughters. And there is no more important issue for that world than climate change.
And isn't Bill McKibben planning to do another massive action after the election?
Not just an action. Bill is, and the 350.org crew and a number of other organizations joining with him, are planning a national organizing tour. It starts on November 10th, I think, or help me with this, David. I don't remember the exact, but it's just a couple days after the election, and he's going to be barnstorming from city to city along with Naomi Klein, my colleague at The Nation magazine, and various musical and local guests, organizing people in this, you know, place after place after place. And specifically, the organizing now that Bill and the others are doing gets back to the same theme I raised in my piece in The Nation, which is we've got to go after the fossil fuel industry. It's not, you know, climate change has never been primarily a technical problem. It has been a political and ultimately economic problem. It's the fact that that industry, the richest in history, has had a de facto veto power over U.S. policy for decades, and we have got to break that. And that's the goal of what McKibben and the others are going to be doing starting, I think, November 8th is when it begins.
And the team over at Fire Dog Lake, which is a political blog, had some criticism for this, saying, why are they doing it after the election? Why don't they do it before to force the candidates to take this issue seriously?
There were a lot of people trying to force the candidates to take the issue seriously, and it didn't really happen until Hurricane Sandy. Mike Tidwell, who's a writer on this, I thought had a very good line in that regard, again in The Nation just a couple days ago. His lead was to his piece was, the candidates in 2012 decided they weren't going to talk about climate change, so climate change decided to talk to them.
All right, well, thank you again for the phone call, Kevin, and let's hear next from Ruby in Mill Valley. Hi, Ruby.
Hi, good morning. Thanks so much. When I have been watching news and reading for the last couple of weeks, I believe I saw the report on the degenerating nature of the satellites, which give us the weather information, that they're breaking down, they're worn out, and if they go, we're really screwed. You should pardon my French. And I haven't seen anything in the press about it. I'm wondering what your guests know about that, and why we're not putting up something else or repairing them. I guess it's very, very expensive. And secondly, was there enough warning to the people of New York based on this information? Were enough shelters open? Were there transportation plans put into effect in enough time to get these aged who are on the upper floors of these high-rises? You know, you look at the coverage and you think, okay, what about a bomb? You know, what about an attack? It's a joke to talk about get out of town. It's not possible. So I really didn't see much coverage on the preparation for this massive storm they knew was coming, and they only knew it because we had satellites. And if those go, where are we?
Well, thank you, Ruby. David, what's your response?
I don't know a ton about the satellite issue in particular. I've heard a lot of conflicting things about that, but I think this gets at a very important general point, which is a lot of what this shows us is that our infrastructure is decaying, not only our physical infrastructure, but our scientific infrastructure and our infrastructure of research. You know, we've allowed investments in that stuff to decay and decay and decay, and now we're reaching a time in our history where we really need to be resilient to these, you know, these increasingly frequent extreme events, and we really need to know better how they work and when and how they're going to develop and when they're coming, and all of that, capability which we had in which we were so proud of in post-war America has been decaying for decades now, largely as a result, I think, of the sort of philosophy that Mitt Romney's now running on, which is, the private sector will provide. I think we're really seeing now just how badly we need coordinated federal spending on science and research and infrastructure.
Yeah, and Mark, I was actually struck by an interview that NPR's Steve Inskeep did with oceanography professor Malcolm Bowman at Long Island Stony Brook University about these sea barriers. And he said that it's time to really take this seriously. I don't know how they would work, and I do wonder what effect they would have on sea life. But he said they would cost about $6 billion. He actually said if New York City had these sea barriers, this damage would not have been done.
I write about that a lot in my book, Hot, the whole question of trying to protect New York City from sea barriers. And, of course, the people who know how to do this the best in the world are the Dutch. I interviewed a lot of them about this. And I think that there's no question that that's going to happen in New York City before too very long. Mm-hmm. New York City is simply too economically valuable not to protect it, even though I think $6 billion is probably underestimated for how much it would cost. Essentially, you'd probably do, the way at least it's been described to me, three different barriers. You'd run one from basically Staten Island over to the Jersey Shore and then going west, and then Staten Island east to Brooklyn. So you'd cut off or protect the southern entrance to New York City. And then you'd also run one up above the Throgs Neck so that you protect New York from and sort of Queens and the Bronx from water going down the East River. The problem with that, and there's no way around this, is that you nevertheless will leave large portions of New York City outside of protection, including, for example, the areas of Queens where there's the Kennedy Airport. Now, probably you would still put barriers, the experts say, around Kennedy Airport because, again, it's just too valuable not to. But none of these things should be seen as a silver bullet because you're going to people unprotected. It is going to be costly and so forth. One quick thing on the satellites. The caller is correct. There's a piece in The Atlantic magazine, at least on the website, that goes into this in some detail. And yeah, just imagine if we had not known, because we didn't have satellites, what would have happened if we hadn't known that Hurricane Sandy was coming and was going to be as big as it was. That's what you get when you follow the Republican mantra of cut government, cut government, cut government, no matter what, we have to cut it.
That is Mark Hertzgard with The Nation magazine, author of Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. David Roberts is a staff writer for Grist. We've got full lines. We'll have a few open in a couple minutes. You can also leave a comment on our website or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Why don't we go through a few callers and then we'll get responses from Mark and David. Let's hear from Rodolfo in Oakland. Hi, Rodolfo. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Yes, the whole thing about the human-caused catastrophic climate change is, it's entirely a contrivance of the stinking United Nations, which smells an income stream in the air, which it can use to play world government with the mud hut countries of the world. And this is the the most giant propaganda effort that we have seen since Joseph Goebbels walked this earth.
Okay, so you don't believe in climate change.
There is. Well, climate change happens all the time, but it's natural. It is not anything that we have anything to do with.
All right, well, we'll get a response, because we hear about this in this country constantly, and there's a lot of information about that. So we'll get a response in just a couple minutes. Let's hear next from David in San Francisco. Hi, David. Hello, David? David? All right, well, let me just read. We have a number of emails. I'll read one from Stephen. Did anyone else find it strange that when a heckler interrupted Romney's stump speech by yelling about climate change, the crowd started chanting USA, USA, as if patriotism was the logical response to a global crisis? Yeah, I just heard that this morning. Thank you for that email, Stephen. And Maria writes, I just wanted to quickly mention the fact that the New York Marathon is still a go, even after all the devastation that Sandy has left. The start is in Staten Island, one of the hardest hit areas, and I think it's appalling that they would even consider throwing a celebration during this time. I wanted to hear some comments. Thank you, Maria in Santa Cruz. And Laura writes, please ask your guests about Sandy's effects in Haiti and Cuba. There has been virtually nothing about it in the news as everyone is so focused on New York. And we have another email about Jill Stein. Jill Stein has made the issue of climate change an issue from the very beginning of her campaign. On her website are several pages dedicated to climate change, including one with endorsements from leading environmental leaders. And of course, Jill Stein is running for president of the Green Party, and she was arrested actually on Wednesday morning in East Texas while attempting to bring food and Halloween candy to protesters camping out in trees to oppose the Keystone XL pipeline that has already received permits running from Cushing, Oklahoma to the Texas Gulf of Mexico. So we've got a number of questions and comments in there. And Mark, I'm sure you get this all the time, the skepticism from Rodolfo, who says that climate change is natural.
I don't call it skepticism. A real skeptic is willing to look at the evidence and change his or her mind if necessary. The people who have been saying that this is a hoax, which is basically what this guy is saying, have shown that they're not really interested in the evidence, because if they were, they would have to confront the fact that our National Academy of Sciences, and which is like the Supreme Court for science in this country, and its equivalent, its counterpart in Britain, France, Germany, Canada, Japan, Russia, China, etc., all over the world, and all of the professional academies, the American Physics Society, the chemists, the geophysicists, and so forth, all of them are saying repeatedly for 15 years now, man-made climate change, not natural, man-made climate change is real, it's happening now, and it is going to cause very severe damages if we don't do something about it. So these people who are saying that it's false, and by the way, these people include most of the Republican Congress and the Republican presidential and vice presidential candidate, basically what they're saying is that all of the world's scientists are either crooked or incompetent. Now, if you prefer to believe that, go ahead. But in that case, I hope you're not going to fly on an airplane or visit a doctor's office, because the science around climate change at this point is about as controversial as all the science that underlies our use of automobiles and airplanes and modern medicine.
David, anything to add to that?
I would just add that for those of us who have been watching over the last 20 years the UN's attempt to deal with climate change, to muster some sort of coordinated response to climate change, find it supremely ironic, this notion that the UN has the power to engineer a global scientific conspiracy and keep its fingerprints completely off it, and yet totally unable to do anything about the fake problem that it arranged this conspiracy about. It's
Good point, David.
That particular conspiracy theory has internal contradictions.
Well, in many cases, we do see people quoted in reports saying that this is not happening without being challenged by reporters. So you often see, what you know, quote, both sides getting the same degree of attention.
You know, I actually think, and this is...
Not so much anymore, but...
It really is on the decline. I see less and less of that. There are still problems with coverage in terms of the tone and frequency and content, but one thing I see very... little of anymore is this notion that we have to have kind of the token science denier in our piece so we can get both sides. I think that has largely faded from the habits, from the sort of habits and professional standards of the media, to its credit.
And Laura brought up Haiti and Cuba, and so far in Haiti there have been 54 deaths, another 200,000 homeless, in addition to the 370,000 that are in tent camps after the hurricane. The New York Times headline was yet another blow to Haiti from a natural disaster. So it's almost like, you know, poor Haiti is dealing with these endless tragedies. What are your thoughts about how that has been covered, Mark?
I think this is a good reason why, and I'm happy that KALW so often uses the BBC news feed. I have the BBC news as my homepage because the BBC has been on this story, and they have a story today about how cholera now is the big fear in Haiti in the aftermath of this. And so this gets to another aspect of the U.S. media, that the U.S. media in general is simply much less interested in things that happen outside of our borders, whether it be in relation to climate change or anything, really. And it's, so if you're out there and you want better information about what's going on in Haiti and Cuba and so forth or other places in the world, you know, go to the BBC or go to the Guardian newspaper. But the BBC has an international set of correspondents. They really do a great job with foreign news. And, of course, it's in the English language.
Yes, and Reuters, I mean, this is devastating. Reuters reports that since October 2010, a cholera outbreak in Haiti has sickened almost 600,000 and killed more than 7,400. I didn't realize it was so high.
Yeah, well, It's when you put together disease and poverty, that's what happens. And this, by the way, raises another thing that should be brought up in the context of this program, was a report that came out about, 2 weeks ago now. I wrote about it in the Daily Beast, but aside from that, I didn't see any coverage in the U.S. media, which was a major new report commissioned by 20 of the world's governments whose nations stand to be most hard hit by climate change. And they pulled together top-level scientists, and they found that climate change today is killing 400,000 people a year, most of them children. And if you work out the math, that means roughly 1,000 kids a day are dying because of climate change, usually because of issues related to hunger and malnutrition, which, of course, makes them more susceptible to other diseases. So we need to bear in mind, and David touched on this earlier in our conversation this morning, it is the poor who are getting hurt the worst by climate change. And yet, they're the ones who we often ignore. If there is a silver lining, again, to Hurricane Sandy, it is a little bit that now the rich and the powerful and the influential in and around New York City have been touched by this themselves, and so therefore they are showing, I think, more interest in the problem. It's about time.
Well, it'll see how this plays out, because I spoke to a friend in New York, and she said these two sides are just not really talking to each other. They know what's happening. She said there are far more homeless people on the streets, not really knowing what to do, but they're not really talking to each other. But to that point, we just got an email from Henry who says, how about some mention of the work of Occupy Sandy? It's the offshoot of Occupy Wall Street that's gone to work in Red Hook in Brooklyn, I believe, right? Do you know? Because Democracy Now! Actually had a great segment this morning where they went to Red Hook. And it is in Brooklyn. It's basically a community effort to help people with food and water and things like that. And the Huffington Post has also been covering this. Are you familiar with that, Mark or David?
I'm not, no, but I'm glad to hear that, I mean, that sounds like exactly the kind of story that needs to be done, and to get more visibility, not just at HuffPost and Democracy Now! is as wonderful as they are, but in the broader mainstream media.
It does bring up something interesting, which is that, you know, I think we've mentioned several times now that the poor and vulnerable are, you know, on the front lines of this, going to get hurt worse. But it's also the case that if you want to build these, you know, if you want to build these seawalls, for instance, to protect Manhattan, the estimate I heard is that building a seawall to protect New York Harbor would be $15 billion. And that's just New York Harbor. And it's not just the poor who are going to have to pay for that. You know, this is going to start hitting the wealthy in New York in the pocketbook, too. It's not something they're going to be able to brush off for long. And you build a seawall for a foot of sea level rise, say. What if we're wrong about sea level rise and it rises 2 feet by 2050 or 2060? Then you're building another seawall and another seawall. And I think what we're starting to see now, just with the amount of money that's getting tossed around today at the very front end of the climate changes that are on the way, is it's just not practical to be constantly adapting to a changing climate. Sooner or later, we're going to have to take seriously the idea that we need to stabilize temperatures. I think a lot of people say, oh, we'll just adapt to the changes, and don't really work through what that's going to mean. But it's not just poor people who are going to end up on the hook for this. It's going to be extraordinarily expensive to protect everybody. And I think once you, you know, once you see wealthy people really starting to get hit in the pocketbook, I think the tone of coverage of this problem, I think it'll take on a very different tone.
Well, we've got time for one more caller, so let's go to David in San Francisco. Hi, David, and we're almost out of time.
Oh, yeah, hi. Rose and your guest. You know, it's funny, you were talking about remediation. Most climate scientists agree that if we did a massive amount of reforestation, putting in trees all over everywhere, that would sop up the water. With global warming, you get more water vapors, and that comes down as rain, and we're going to end up with feast and floods, feast and famine. We'll end up with flash floods and droughts, and so the idea of putting in trees is going to not only hold back erosion, but it'll sop up the water it'll hold it into the
Well, David, fiber. Thank you for calling, and I'm sorry to cut you off, but we are just out of time, and after the election we will definitely do a show about solutions. Mark, what are you working on right now?
I'm working on a piece about agriculture and on what climate change is going to be doing to wheat production and specifically to pasta around the world.
Oh.
And agriculture is, as that caller was getting at, agriculture is one of the few sort of cards we still have up our sleeves that we can use to not only adapt and to deal with these kinds of storms, but also to take carbon out of the atmosphere. That's the really key thing. As we go forward, we've got to do both adaptation and mitigation. We've got to turn down the temperatures. We've got to stop the emissions. But we've also got to deal with the amount of climate change that's already there and with seawalls and, you know, reforestation.
Yes.
And that's what I'm working on. That's what Hot was about.
Great. We've been wanting to do a show about the Central Valley, so we'd love to have you on about that. Mark Hertzgard, author of Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. David Roberts, staff writer with Grist. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
And thanks for your emails and phone calls. Thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Here's what's coming up on Monday. What are your last-minute election questions before Tuesday's big vote? On the next Your Call, we'll discuss state ballot propositions by diving into the fine print that could produce big changes in California. What last-minute questions do you have about the propositions? Have basic voting questions been addressed in your community? What are your last-minute concerns? We'll pose them to members of the California Voter Foundation and the League of Women Voters. It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar. And you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
...727 men and women are on death row in California. KALW's Nancy Mullane worked for years for the right to tell their stories. And now we can hear them.
And you've been here for...
7 years, and I don't even know when I'm going to leave. And I'm not the only one. No one knows when we're going
to
leave.
You don't know what the process is to get out?
No, there are rules, but the rules don't apply to us.
Join the first reporter in years to walk the halls of San Quentin's death row. Mondays at 5 on Cross Currents.
Cross Currents, week evenings at 5 o'clock. The series on prisons continues this Monday here on Local Public Radio. Coming up from the World Service of the BBC, it's World Have Your Say, the Tavis Smiley Show at noon. And then at 1 o'clock today, Tavis Smiley and Dr. Cornel West here on Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco. Good morning. The time is 11 o'clock.
Hello, hi. You are very welcome to the World Have Your Say live from Phoenix, Arizona. We are asking, is America working?
I came to the land of opportunity and I have experienced the American dream working here.
My name is Sandy. I come from Brazil, but Phoenix is now my home. I came to America for love, but now work as a financial analyst.
Hi, I'm Emmanuel Abba from South Sudan. I'm here as a refugee to escape civil war. I work now in the healthcare field.
And I am Sulema. I came from Mexico when I was 5, but I am undocumented and I have worked here, but it's not always easy. This hour, we're going to discuss the American dream and how it compares with the reality we found here.
You can ask us a question by posting at facebook.com/wordhaveyoursay.